and welcome to We Are History. A very exciting episode today, Angela.
Oh, yes. It's a We Are History first this week,
we
John.
We have got a guest.
Very exciting.
A guest.
We've got a guest. And I think we might have made a terrible mistake, John, because what we've done is we've invited like a proper bona fide historian to the podcast.
It's going to be so shown up.
And they're going to show us
somebody who's read more than the Ladybird books.
This might be the first and last time we do this.
But I think perhaps because this episode was so very much inspired by her book, we have invited on Hallie Rubenhold, who has written a book called The Five.
We have. So this is an episode, let's get this straight from the start. It's not an episode about Jack the Ripper, and it's not necessarily about the case, the serial killer himself. He's not the only serial killer. He wasn't the first. He won't be the last. And, well, we know he's not the last. There's been hundreds of them. But for some reason, Jack the Ripper has sort of entered this almost folkloric state of London history, you know, to the point where there's museums and waxwork figures and all sorts about this sort of caped...
Yes. Top-hatted villain.
Exactly.
Stalking the dark streets of London.
Exactly.
And it's a sort of, it is like a pantomime villain. And it's, it took this book from Hallie to make everyone stop and go, hang on a minute. Well, five women at least were murdered here.
Yeah.
So
the bottom line is this is a serial killer of women. And, you know, these women died in horrific ways. Yet very few people can name the women. There were the Whitechapel murders, as they know, and there were 11 of them, but there were five, they call them the canonical five, who were linked to Jack the Ripper. It's believed that he definitely killed
the manner of the murders was very much the same.
Exactly.
So Angela, you're leading on this one.
I am.
So do you want to set the scene?
I will. So we are in the late 19th century. The 1880s, late 1880s, in Whitechapel in East London. Whitechapel and Spitalfields is the area where the murders took place. And they took place between August and November that year.
The year being 1888,
1888,
is that right?
1888, that's right.
Yes.
So it's from the 3rd of April to February 19... Well, that's when the Whitechapel murders started. The canonical five were from August to November.
Okay.
I think it's important to get, because we're in the Victorian era, and I think a lot of what we think we know about the Victorians is very much based on middle and upper class Victorians.
Yes.
Isn't it? So we think of the Victorians as this sort of uptight moral society whereby we actually know that, you know, there's a lot of sexual oppression. So they were a little bit naughty and a little bit into the macabre and all of that stuff. But the sort of social mores that we think of when we think of the Victorians don't really apply to the working classes, right? It was not a good time to be poor.
No.
You had workhouses, which were institutions that were set up for the completely destitute.
Of which there were many.
There were many. But you would fight to avoid the workhouse. The workhouse wasn't safe option.
It wasn't all like Oliver, the musical, with everyone singing and dancing and all, you know, tap dancing down the cobbled streets of London, was it?
Apparently not. No, it wasn't. No. It was grotesque and humiliating. If you and your family were sent to the workhouse, you would be processed when you arrived. You would be split up from your husband. As a woman, you were only allowed to keep your children with you if they were under 6 or 7 years old. Otherwise, they would be taken from you into workhouse education. You would then be stripped of all your clothes and put in a workhouse uniform. You would have to bath in the same water that everyone else had bathed in that day.
Yeah.
And it was about taking away your dignity and your... Because it was very much believed, you know, that the poor were deserving of everything that they...
Yes, I mean, the thing that's so striking about studying this period, which I did for this one, or reading a bit about it, especially in Hallie Rubenhold's book, was just that the absolute destitution of the majority of Londoners and of, I suppose, of elsewhere, in the richest country in the world, and we always talk about the empire and how the goods have flowed into Britain, but But this was benefited only a very narrow minority of people. And the poverty was terrible for ordinary people.
Yeah.
There was no sense that that would be shared with the ordinary Briton.
No. And because of trying to avoid the workhouse, because once you were in the workhouse, you were tainted with that. That's on your record. That is would stop you then getting work or anything. Yeah. Most work was casual, of course. There weren't the employment rights and unions that we have today.
Or had.
And... So many people, working class, low income people, were living in lodging houses, common house. You'd have entire families, more than one, sharing a room. So the idea that there would be any sort of, as Hallie says in her book, everything that you did in front of your family. You know, there was no privacy, there was no coyness, there was no, you know, your human functions were there.
To be fair, I think Foxtons are still trying to promote that model in the London housing market.
For sure. And there was very much an east-west divide in London, and that east-west divide was sort of intersected by Trafalgar Square. And in 1887, a year before the murders, is when the famous Bloody Sunday took place in Trafalgar Square. So there would be upwards of 400-500 people would sleep rough in Trafalgar Square, washing in the fountains, you know, and it was this big scandal that these people were there. And in 1887, the police were sent in and riots ensued and people were killed and it was just awful. So this is the background of where we're at. And they would have these areas of London that were known as rookeries, Whitechapel, Spitalfields being a rookery. And they were, it was sort of a euphemistic name for these areas where people were so poor that crime was rife and sex work was rife. And I think what's really important to remember is that as a woman at that time, you had no recourse to any sort of public support. You were your husband's property. And if he wasn't supporting you, no one was. Yes. You know, so if you had a violent husband, a drunk husband, anything like that, you couldn't just leave him because you weren't allowed to divorce him. You know, you wouldn't receive any support. You would be seen as the failure for failing.
So this was
to
very much the context of these women who lived in Whitechapel, probably resorted to alcohol quite often, who were desperate, you know, just to get money for the lodgings for one night.
Absolutely. So they would live literally hand to mouth. You know, whether you have money for that night, for a bed that night in a lodging house, if you didn't have it, you'd be kicked out. Very few possessions. Quite a lot of them would carry all their possessions with them, you know, sewn into pockets in their skirts.
A comb and a linen hanky is about it, wasn't it? Yeah.
The sort of overarching narrative, and I think what most people assume, they know, Jack the Ripper is one of those things, isn't it? Because you've grown up with the stories around. I think everyone thinks they know the story of Jack the Ripper. Ripper, the man who murdered prostitutes in the East End. That's...
Yeah. You know, so take us through the basic facts, Angela, without dwelling on him.
Well, without dwelling on him, we don't know who he is and we never will, I think is the first thing to say. There's a million theories. And if that's what floats your boat, you can go and research it. There's lots of books, lots of literature, lots of things to read. But what we do know is that these five women were most likely murdered by the same man. They think he possibly had a surgical background or a medical background because of the manner in which he dismembered their bodies.
Yep.
There was around the time of the murders in the East End, there was a large influx of immigrants, particularly from Ireland and Jewish immigrants fleeing the Eastern Europe at that time. And they were viewed with a lot of suspicion. That if you look at newspaper articles at the time, there's quite a lot of anti-Semitism around this case. People assuming because it did not fit into the narrative of the decent, moral British imperialist that this murderer could have been a British man.
It's always easier to blame the outsider.
Always. Yeah. I mean, that could never happen today, John.
No, thank goodness. Like thank goodness we've moved on.
We've got past blaming immigrants for everything. But then, you know, the fact that these people were so destitute and poor and, you know, you had dock workers competing for work on the docks and the narrative they were taught, obviously same as today, is that look at this foreigner, he's taking your work, right? Not that there's a problem with trickle-down economy and there's a problem higher above. It's that foreigner's fault. And that was very much the case at that time as well. So it was largely assumed that he was a foreign gentleman, but that's not known at all. I use the word gentleman there in very loosely.
Yes, One of them was described, one of the witnesses said he was, he looked like he'd been a foreign gentleman, didn't they? And they'd only seen the back of his head or something.
Exactly, yeah. And that was Mrs. Long, who was the last person to see, I believe it was Annie Chapman alive, who was the second victim. And she said that he was a foreign gentleman. And of course, the newspapers, the police, everyone just ran with that. Oh, he's a foreigner. But actually, she'd only seen a cloaked figure from behind. She'd made that assumption, you know. So, and of course, it fitted the narrative of the time to say that he was a foreign man.
Yes.
Just very quickly before we talk to Hallie, I just quickly run through who these five victims were, because I think it's really important that we say their names and we say their names, because they were women who found themselves in awful situation that, I mean, I reading Hallie's book, and I do, obviously I recommend it. It's called The Five and it's incredible, but I cried because the frustration of reading their stories and seeing how they got into the situations they were in, regardless of the background they came from. They were all from a poor background, but some, you know, more sort of upper lower class than others. The first victim was Mary Ann, or Polly Nichols. At 18, she married a printer's machinist, and they got married at the printer's church, St. Bride's in the East End, the one that looks like a wedding cake.
Yes.
And her mother died, and she got married, and she and her five children lived with her father for a while. Now, there's a thing to say about these women having lots of children. I think with today's head on, we go, why did they just keep having children they couldn't support? You have to remember, they didn't have access to contraception. Yeah. They didn't have access to information about contraception. Contraception was written about in the Victorian era, but if you were illiterate, you didn't get that information.
And they weren't in a position to say no to their husbands.
Absolutely. There was no such thing as marital rape in those days. And that was your job as a woman, was to. Yeah. And if you got pregnant, you just had to deal with it. So, they had five children. They lived in one of the Peabody buildings. George Peabody was an American philanthropist who donated quite a lot of money, I think about £500,000 at that time, to housing the poor in London. And the Peabody estates, you can still see them around London.
Yeah.
They lived there. Her husband started having an affair with a neighbour. She was not able to divorce him on grounds of adultery. That wasn't allowed. Women couldn't divorce their husbands on grounds of adultery. Only husbands could divorce their wives on grounds of adultery. So eventually she couldn't cope with this relationship he was having, and she left him. Her only choice was to present herself to the workhouse, because you had to prove in order to get a divorce that you'd been deserted.
Right.
So that's how Polly Nichols found herself in that situation. Annie Chapman, a completely different situation. Her father was in the army, was very well respected. She lived in West London, between West London, sort of Notting Hill around that area, and Windsor. Her family were very involved in the temperance movement, but Annie unfortunately got a taste for rum quite early on. And that is something that is common with these women. But I say to people who judge them on that, the same as I say to people who judge homeless people today who take drugs or whatever, is how the hell would you get through a night on the streets without it? She got married to a footman who had quite a good job with a nobleman who lived in Bond Street. And so they were quite well-to-do, lower class. So she would have had staff at one point herself, you know, and so her background wasn't as desperate as the others. However, she was a drinker. And eventually she had been drunk and disorderly too many times. She had stillborn children. She had children born with alcohol fetal syndrome that didn't survive. She had one daughter that survived, one daughter that died of meningitis age 12, and a son who had a severe disability. And so her husband had to make the choice that, because she kept getting caught for being drunk and disorderly, he was in danger of losing his job. So he had to abandon her with an allowance, because he was still responsible for her. And despite the efforts of her family, she ended up on the streets in Whitechapel drinking. No evidence that she was a prostitute.
That's something we should say about all of these women, apart from perhaps the last one, is that there was little evidence, or no evidence really, that they were working as what they call prostitutes back then. And that's sort of one of the points of Hallie's book, really, is that they have been, through sort of common folklore, been described as prostitutes. And it's added an air of titillation and sort of sauciness to this tale of the East London murderer.
They were saucy wenches in alleyways, you know, plying their trade, and it's just not the case.
No, there's no evidence for it. And so Hallie has come along as a proper historian and gone, well, where's the evidence? And there is none. And a lot of presumptions were made, and the attitudes of the police sort of reinforced this at the time. But it's something that needs to be challenged.
Absolutely. So then you had Elizabeth Stride, who was a Swedish woman. She was born in near Gothenburg, Sweden, to a rural family. She got a job in service. Now, she was known to be involved with sex work back in Sweden, and she caught syphilis while in service there. And she eventually, she came to London. She was someone who sort of lived on her wits very much. She came up with stories which she would use. She'd say that her husband died in the Princess Alice disaster, the paddle steamer disaster on the Thames, and her children died in it and things like that. It was all ways to survive, really. By the way, Crash Bang Wallop podcast do an excellent episode on the Princess Alice sinking. So do give that a listen. Oh, okay. It's really good. I mean, it's a harrowing, but it's really interesting.
Right.
She cleaned to make money. In fact, the day before she was murdered, she'd made money by cleaning lodging houses. Again, there's no evidence that she was actually plying a sex work trade at that time in London. They know she had a history of it before, but there's nothing to say that that's what she was doing that night. Same with Kate Eddowes, who, again, it's alcohol was her main problem. She'd been born in Wolverhampton. She'd moved to London when she was very young, about a year old. And actually, she had a relatively good start in life because she was one of the lucky children who was sent to the Dowgate Charity School.
Right.
Which there were several charity schools in London, which if you were a girl, you were lucky to get a place there and start to get an education. But sadly, she was orphaned at 15. She ended up in a workhouse. And then her sisters sent her back to relatives in Wolverhampton. She then met up with a peddler called Thomas Conway, an Irish retired soldier. And she took up with him and they worked as balladeers, chaunters, did that circuit, selling poems and things to people on the street. So she was very itinerant. She would, you know, they would move around a lot till they started to have children.
She would have been a Mot of the Week.
She would have. No, she wouldn't. She was a woman.
Oh, sorry, what was I thinking?
Yeah, what were you thinking? Now, it's also worth saying that we think of Victorians as being, you know, no sex before marriage and marriage being...
Yes.
Many, many, many working class couples were not married. To get married would cost too much money, would be something they didn't have the time to do. So they
sort of hook up for a bit.
Yeah. And if your relationship didn't survive for whatever reason, whether you were widowed, whether he left you, whether he beat you, whatever, it was in your best interest to attach yourself to another man as quickly as possible, because a woman on her own was not able to make enough money to survive, you know, doing bits of crochet work, cleaning, charring. You couldn't survive. So that's why they would take up with other men. Again, we use our sort of modern day judgment on it, where you can survive as a single woman, but in that time you just couldn't. The night that Kate Eddowes was murdered, she'd been drinking with John Kelly, who was the man she was with at the time, and she'd gone off to try and find lodgings, but she'd got drunk, she'd been arrested. The police turned her out again when she'd sobered up a bit at 1 a.m. and the probability is that she'd tried to find John, failed, slept rough somewhere, and that's when she succumbed to the Ripper.
All of them were murdered, they think, in their sleep. They were all had their throats slashed whilst asleep, lying down. Gruesome, similar pattern in all of them.
Absolutely. All of them, of course, until the final one, Mary Jane Kelly, were all murdered on the street outside.
Yeah.
Mary Jane Kelly, not so much is known about her background, but she was a sex worker and was openly a sex worker. She worked a lot in the West End, so she was quite a high-class prostitute in that she would, you know, court gentlemen in that scene. She was originally from, well, she says she was born in Ireland and was raised in Wales. Nobody really knows that much about her. It's said that she might have been married at some point. She was sent to Paris at one point. There was a lot of, and Hallie talks about this in the book as well, a lot of trafficking of sex workers around Europe at that time. So they think she may have been trafficked by her French landlady. She returned after a couple of weeks. She met up with a fish porter eventually she settled with, and they moved into a sparsely furnished single room in Miller's Court. Now, she was the final victim of the Ripper. Obviously, when news of these attacks were in the papers, it was a very scary time to be a poor woman at that time, you know. And so she would invite friends of hers who were prostitutes to stay in their rooms for safety.
Right.
And her gentleman, Joseph Barnett, wasn't too keen on that. So he sort of abandoned her, left her there in the rooms. And it was in bed in her room where she was murdered.
But all this time, of course, the police are unable to find anything. The pressure is growing on the Home Secretary. The London newspapers are loving every gory detail of it and whipping up hatred.
Oh, yeah.
There's letters.
Again, that could never happen today.
No. Letters to the Scotland Yard from people claiming to be Jack the Ripper. There's a human kidney.
So many hoaxes. There's only one letter that they thought, well, the famous From Hell letter, which there's a whole film about. But that letter is the only one that's thought could have come from the Ripper himself, because it contained half a kidney. Yes. And he claimed that he'd eaten the other half. Yes. And of course, this played into the idea of the savage foreigner, because, you know, a British person wouldn't indulge in cannibalism. That couldn't possibly
Absolutely.
Happen.
But then the murders suddenly stopped.
Yeah. And nobody really knows what happened, whether he left the country, died, ended up in prison for something else. Nobody knows. But I think what's interesting about the whole story is the cult that has grown up around it, and the fact that, you know, even today, people are morbidly fascinated with this case and still think they can solve it, you know.
Yes. I remember back in the my youth, I used to write at Spitting Image, which is back now on our screens, but we were in this East End sort of factory where we used to do the show. And every now and then there'd be a crowd outside the window and you'd hear this guide go, and the Ripper's third victim was found just here. And you'd see all these sort of Japanese tourists sort of taking picture of this 1960s sort of car park. and they're still advertising these tours online now. You can still see them there saying the East End has changed very little since then. And you think, well, it has changed completely. It was all bombed to high heaven in the 1940s and then demolished since. But they try and sort of market this sort of, down the lanes of London you will go, like Jack the Ripper before you, you know. And it's sort of sick.
Well, I think I have a sort of theory that I think in our mind's eye, it's sort of tied in with the world of Sherlock Holmes. That sort of London, you know, it's the same London, isn't it, that you think of, that sort of foggy. But, you know, of course, Sherlock Holmes
Jekyll
is
and Hyde.
Yeah, but they're not real. Whereas this is five women brutally murdered and are not ever really considered in the story. So that's, in a nutshell, the story of Jack the Ripper. We're going to have a little break. And in our second half, we're going to talk to Hallie Rubenhold, who wrote the book, The Five, and just get her view on the sort of cult that's grown up around Jack the Ripper.
And indeed, I'm very interested in the reaction to her book, which I think tells us a lot about the misogyny that is still with us. We'll see you after this.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone, to part two of We Are History. We are joined after a little bit of
by another
technical
person, John. It's exciting.
It's exciting. We've been just spent a week and a half trying to sort out the technical stuff, but I think we're there. Welcome to We Are History, Hallie Rubenhold.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Now that we've managed to get the tech sorted out, I realise I'm a historian. I'm really not a tech expert. And so anything modern just really does my head in.
This is our lives now, isn't it? We have to dedicate a certain amount of time every day to going, my Wi-Fi's not working, or this isn't working, or how do I do this? That's
exactly.
Just, we're building that into our lives now.
Anyway, Hallie, welcome to We Are History. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're our first ever guest. We feel very honoured to have you, award-winning historian, the Bailey Gifford Prize, the 5-1, which is about the most significant non-fiction prize, I think, isn't it?
Yes, right.
So congratulations on the publication of your book.
John, we've got someone bona fide on who's going to show us up. John.
So history was the olden days, is that right?
Yeah, the olden days, way back when, ye old.
That's right. Well, we wanted to have you on because we both read your book and are very interested in how I think you really sort of reframed a bit of history. And that's not something that every historian can claim to have done. You said this is what has been accepted as the common sort of received knowledge on this period and this incident. And you said, I'm not having that. And you turned it on its head and people have gone, yes, she's right. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Tell us how you came to come by it.
Well, I mean, interestingly, you know, I often tell people I sort of came through the back door to this because the first book I wrote, The Covent Garden Ladies, was such a hit, did so well. And that was about sex workers in 18th century London. And I thought I'd like to do what I did for women who had no voice in the 18th century. I'd like to do that for women in the 19th century. And okay. And I thought, well, who are the most famous sex workers in the 19th century? Well, that would be the victims of Jack Ripper. And of course, as soon as I started doing this research, you know, one of the first things I came across was, you know, the question of, were they actually sex workers? Because the evidence that I was looking at certainly didn't point to that for all five of them.
Wow. That Covent Garden book is the inspiration for Harlots, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's right.
So Angela's been leading on this and doing the sort of was doing most of the talking in the first half. Angela, you gave us a quick sort of summation of the five women involved.
Well, I think what's really important is to say their names, right? Because
absolutely,
until I read the five, I couldn't have told you the names of any of the victims of Jack the Ripper. I was never. I know a lot of people have read a lot of stuff, you know, the stuff's out there, isn't it? If you want it, the films, the movies, the books, the magazines, the websites, whatever, if you're into it. But what do you think it is about this particular serial killer that still keeps people interested today? Because he's not the first serial killer. There's been plenty since him. Well, what is it about this story?
I think that's a really good question. And I think there are lots of things that feed into this. First of all, obviously, it's an unsolved mystery. Nobody yes. knows who he was. He was never caught. And obviously, we're assuming it was a he. It could have been a woman, probably not a woman, but it could have been a group of people. We just don't know. And do you know what? We're never going to know. That's the reality of it. It sort of has entered into national legend. It's become a national myth. And it entered into legend. I mean, it was a headline that frightened people at the same time that a lot of other fictional things were frightening people. So at the same time that you had Jekyll and Hyde, the same time yes. you had Dracula, the same time you had the birth of Sherlock Holmes, you yes. had Jack the Ripper. And all of this fed into I didn't want to
sort of gothic horror, yes, sort of, yeah.
A gothic horror, a kind of cultural yeah. moment for yes. Britain. And so it's not surprising also that we find that this has become mythologized, and also that people seem to be rather confused about Jack the Ripper having been a real person and having killed real people.
Yes. So he's become a sort of pantomime villain, hasn't he? Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's interesting you mentioned Dracula, because I think the red cloak and the, you know, the black cloak with the red lining comes straight from Dracula, really, from Bram Stoker's book.
And, yeah, it really does. You know, and there was so much speculation as to who Jack the Ripper was. And, you know, for a while there was this whole thing about, oh, Jack the Ripper was a toff. And, you know, so you get yeah. this idea of this man running around in the top hat and the cape with a cane. I mean, there's yeah. The one thing that we can almost say absolutely for certain is that Jack the Ripper was not running through the East End of London in 1888 in a top hat, carrying a cane and wearing a cape. You know, for a very, very basic reason, which again is very much rooted in social history, which is we know that, well, first of all, there was this trend for what was called slumming. And right. so wealthy people from the West End would come into the East End for a night out, and often they would put on the clothes of very poor people, and they try to fit in with the general population, and they have a night out. But the thing is, and this is mentioned in a lot of journalism, also Jack London does it around 1900 when he writes People of the Abyss, but the people who lived in the East End, the poor, could recognize somebody who was not poor. Didn't matter if they were wearing the garb. It was
they weren't skinny, their eyes weren't hollowed out.
But it's even more basic than that. It was in the gait. It was in the speech. It was in the way they conducted themselves. It was, class divisions were so entrenched at that time. And
it's a bit like male stand-up comics now going, have you ever noticed,
Yeah.
It's like, we can tell you're posh. Stop trying to fool us.
Yeah.
Well, class tourism's still a thing, isn't it? That you still, there's the pulp song, Common People, is about exactly that, isn't it? Yeah.
And the Mockney accent. I went to Harrow, but I'm going to pretend I grew up in Dagenham.
So, I mean, the myth endured, and a notion that they were all prostitutes or sex workers, as we might say now, would that immediate, or is that something that's evolved over time?
Well, it's the way the media handled the headlines. Yeah. But it's also, again, with all of these things, it's very rare that there's just one simple explanation for why things happened. So Victorian society is to blame for the construing of these women in the way that they were, and obviously the press printed it. But the idea that a woman without a home, without a family, who was leading what was called an irregular life, was somehow morally damaged and morally deficient. And by morally deficient and morally damaged, this was conflated with what I would say, there's the fallen woman and the broken woman. So the broken woman is the woman who, may have mental problems, is homeless, drinks, has a whole kind of, the whole range of problems. And the fallen woman, who we know very much from Victorian fiction and television and this sort of thing, who is the woman who has had sex outside of marriage. And if you are morally compromised, if you were a deficient woman, which a woman on the street would have been, all of this stuff is conflated.
Yes.
It's all one in the same. So a woman living on the street, they didn't care, if she was a homeless woman. A homeless woman meant you were probably having sex with all sorts of people. You were morally defective. You were a broken woman. So it was one and the same. And nobody bothered to find out.
But if you're a journalist in Victorian times, it's a little more salacious to say that they were prostitutes rather than they were just,
the assumption
grim
was
homeless
made.
Alcoholics.
Yeah, the assumption was made by society in general. Also, but also it makes for good copy,
That's
in a
think,
sense.
Yeah,
what you're saying is, in effect, these women are getting what's coming to them.
That's what I think is interesting about it. And that's why I think it's endured so much, that the idea of the bad woman punished.
Yes.
Even though it was a very brutal and savage death by this random murderer, there's a sort of Victorian Christian notion that's been handed down that, thou must be good and thou must only have sex in marriage. Or this will be your fate.
Exactly. And being society's moral compass was the job of women. And so if a woman failed at that job, then, she's really failed everybody.
And as you say in your book, that's something that endures, isn't it? It endured with Steve Wright, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The killer in Ipswich,
yeah.
Where the judge had to say to the jury, the fact that these women were sex workers does not mean they deserved
to be
what
murdered.
Happened to them.
Exactly.
This is not their punishment. And that was in the 21st century that point was still having to be made to a jury. So this is something that endures, isn't it? This idea that they are somehow, these women, because they were sex workers, regardless of the fact that most of them probably weren't, but that they somehow deserved what was coming to them, it was the fault of their lifestyle. And rather than the focus being on the man who is deficient in murdering women.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was reading about all that, I did this idea popped into my head, which I don't know whether it's got, any merit at all, but I wonder if the amount of publicity given to Jack the Ripper and his murder of apparent prostitutes has sort of fed into the damaged psyche of the Ipswich murderer or the Yorkshire Ripper, and that those murderers were influenced by this sort of template that was set down by Victorian Britain. I'm sure there's all sorts of mad psychology going on inside those men's heads, but maybe making prostitutes a target was sort of invented by this Jack myth and then developed, you know, in the 20th century. I have no idea.
I think it's something that is, I mean, even if you look at someone like Jimmy Savile, you know, the fact that he would target girls that were reform school or...
Yeah, it's marginalised, you know, people. Marginalised people tend to be victims of crime. Yes. You know, I mean, look at Dennis Nielsen as well.
Yes, absolutely.
You know,
yes.
It's
yes.
exactly the same situation. And, you know, it's marginalised people who can disappear, who, you know, who can be picked off and their absence won't be noticed as readily as some high-profile person who goes...
And it's that thing, like if it's a blonde, blue-eyed, middle-class girl that goes missing or is murdered, that's in the headlines. Yeah.
Yes,
Madeleine McCann. Look at Madeleine McCann. Perfect
yeah,
example.
I do remember actually when the Yorkshire, I was only at university, but when the Yorkshire Rippers, one of his last victims was murdered. She was a student at one of the universities there in Yorkshire, I think Leeds. She wasn't a sex worker. And the attention that the BBC News gave to her funeral, they did their whole thing. They played Bridge Over Troubled Waters over it. And even as an 18-year-old, I was really shocked at the sort of contrast with the coverage of the prostitutes who've been murdered. They're saying, this is really sad. That was a bit sad. This is really sad. Mm. They made a sort of qualitative judgment about the individuals who were victims. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's in our lifetimes.
Do you think that's also part of that, going back to Jack the Ripper, partly that sense of it being a comeuppance almost for those women or, you know, well, that's the result of the life that they lived. That's allowed people to be able to
pass judgment,
sort of,
And process it.
And to continue having this fascination with Jack the Ripper, because it was only prostitutes that were murdered. So it's okay.
Yeah,
to,
well,
you know,
that's the idea. It's, you know, the last chapter of my book is called Just Prostitutes, because that's the attitude. Well, you know, they were just prostitutes. Just prostitutes.
And that misogyny lives on. I would love to quiz you a little bit about the reaction to your book, Hallie, because that is like a whole story in itself. So you know, put this history out there and it was very well received. But there's a lot of amateur historians out there who've made it their life's work to find who Jack was. And they were very miffed.
The ripperologists.
Oh, the ripperologists.
A lot of them were very miffed to have a woman come along and sort of change the narrative.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, again, you know, there's no simple explanation for what was motivating them, what's behind these attacks. But I think it's a deeply personal thing for a lot of them because, you know, these and they are mostly men and they are all almost exclusively white. And there are a handful of women. And interestingly, the women are incredibly vicious. It's like women in biker gangs. You know, they have to prove that they are even worse than the men and more vicious. And like watching them do these sort of mental gymnastics to kind of turn it on its head and say that because I didn't find evidence that all five were sex workers, I'm actually anti-sex worker and I'm as bad as Jack the Ripper because I'm now denying these women of their actual identities. And which is the most ridiculous thing. I mean, there's so much.
These are on blogs or something? Or
no,
do they do these?
On blogs. I mean, it's, well, you know.
Your reviews? Do they go on your reviews?
Yes,
do they review?
On my, well, it's so interesting. Now there's this sort of template for how they have now all agreed on what it was exactly I did with this book. And they agreed amongst themselves that I had A. And whenever I see these two terms
phrases
appear, I know this is a ripperologist. That A.
I bet I know what one of those terms is.
Feminist agenda.
Feminist agenda.
Yeah.
I've
feminist
down
agenda.
Feminist agenda there. Look,
I would
I
like to
say
know what exactly is on that feminist agenda, because no one's ever sent me the feminist agenda. I don't know what
minutes
the
of the last meeting.
Yeah.
It's all very boring.
Yeah.
Kind of. Apparently there's a feminist agenda, but I've not been invited to the meeting yet.
Sort
I missed.
Kind of, you know, kind of dominate all men. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I have a feminist agenda and that I have ignored the facts.
Their facts that they published in their self-published books.
Yes, and they all read each other's self-published books, but that the facts, that somehow that, you know, I mean, this is the most extraordinary thing is when I started the research on this, what really blew me away was like, I initially thought there was this like huge body of evidence. So I was going to go to the archives and there were going to be, you know, tons and tons of boxes given to me. And I opened the files and they're newspaper reports. So they don't actually even have from the coroner's inquests.
No, they were burned in the Blitz, weren't they? Some of it was destroyed in the Blitz.
Well, they went missing. People took the files. But the main set of documents that we have that give us an idea about what happened and what witnesses saw and things like that were supposed to be the coroner's inquest reports. So they only exist for Catherine Eddowes and Mary Jane Kelly, the last two. So for the other three, it's missing. So all we have are newspaper reports. And I looked at, I asked a question on one of these forum sites. I said, so what is the definitive source here? What are you working from? What is, you know, is it the Telegraph? Is it the, you know, is it
Illustrated
Times?
Police News?
Is it Illustrated Police News? What? And the response I got was laughter. You know, what do you mean definitive source? Okay, so, you know, so you lay out 10 different versions of what was said by a one witness and you get 10 different versions. Right. So there is no fact here. There is no fact. And actually some of these accounts actively refute others and contradict others. So what are we dealing with? You know, so we have people who are trying to solve this case still.
It's based on newspaper reports.
And you know, things that a police officer has written down. I mean, experts, academics I know who are experts in police history and the experts in, for example, in the history of sex work have said you can't take that stuff on face value because you have to contextualize it with the time and what we know about attitudes.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
So did you try and engage with some of these reparologists?
Oh, yeah, they won't have it, because now they have the script. They think, first of all, they think history is just about finding things, okay? Right. And that they found all this stuff, that I then used all this stuff and then filled my book with padding and lies. So everything that they can't lay claim to is padding and lies, stuff that I made up, okay? So, and this is the script now. This is it.
Wow.
What interests me about them say, you know, accusing you of having a feminist agenda is the sort of refusal to accept that the story as it's been passed on from when it happened to today has been with a patriarchal agenda the entire time. You know, the newspaper reports had that agenda. The, you know, to then say that there's a feminist, it was about time that it was
somebody should speak up for the women, and they would say, well, we're doing that. Yeah. All these white men are doing that. Who have always been more interested in finding out who the killer is.
But I mean, your book has reset the agenda, but it's still out there. You know, researching this, even on things like Wikipedia, it'll say Jack the Ripper murdered 5 prostitutes. And if you go, you know, have you tried, people changed it and had it changed back?
Oh, guess what? Well, Wikipedia, well, this is very interesting. Those sites, the Wikipedia pages for the Ripper victims are dominated by Ripperologists who have basically prevented me and everybody else I know who has actually tried to change stuff on Wikipedia. They have basically banned any mention of my book on those pages.
That's because your name wasn't mentioned on the legacy.
They've actually taken it down. Every time somebody puts it up, they take it down because they say I'm quote unquote fringe because I'm not accepted by the mainstream.
Winner of the Bailey Gifford Prize.
Yes, and nominated for the Wolfson Prize in History.
Hallie, Hallie, we have thousands of listeners to this podcast. Listeners, get on Wikipedia, go on the forum, get on the discussion page
and change this,
make it that any mention of Jack the Ripper and who he murdered, say the names, not the myth that they were prostitutes. You can do it on the Jack the Ripper page. On the year 1888, it says, and their fifth prostitute was murdered. These things can be changed if enough people make a noise and get on those discussion pages that they have on Wikipedia attached to the articles. It's interesting. I think for some of those Ripperologists, their very identity that they have created for themselves is experts in Jack the Ripper, and they suddenly feel like, you know, that's been robbed from them by this woman.
By someone who's actually done the...
Who's got
none of them have history degrees. There's no history degree between them.
You've got several history degrees.
Yeah, I have three.
Three degrees.
In history.
I've got a record by the 3 degrees. But no, a proper historian who does primary research. I wonder how many of them attempted primary research.
Well, they probably have, but it's the thing about history is it's not... History isn't about, you know, finding facts. This isn't solving a crime. They have to understand that any of these documents that, you know, are now 132 years old, first of all, they wouldn't stand up in law today. You're not a police officer on the case. You have to look at these documents as historical documents. You have to contextualize them. You have to unpick them. You have to analyze them. And that's not what is happening here.
Yes. And then the culture hasn't changed sufficiently that automatically we think, let's challenge this. I'm sure you're aware of the Ripper Museum that was opened in the East End in 2015. So the application, did you read about this, Angela? The application for this place was put into Tower Hamlets Council as a museum of women's history. So they granted planning permission that the hoarding went up, and it was the Jack the Ripper Museum. And he said, oh, well, we have named, you know, we've got pictures of all the victims. But it's basically a complete trick that was played on the council. But the guy who set it up had been head of diversity at Google, weirdly. And it was picketed and protest. But, it, you know, it's not stopped. He completely lied about what he was going to do. Went from women's history. It was going to feature things about suffrage and the emancipation
and women's
of women.
Lives.
And instead, it was just about a bloke who murdered a load of women.
That's
women's history.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get murdered. That's the history of women. They get murdered.
And one of the victims lying prone on the ground, bleeding. Right. And you can take pictures with her. So that's
so you still got these tours around London. Did you ever do one of the tours, Hallie?
Do you know what I? At several points, I was tempted, and I just thought, you know, I'm going to get so angry that I won't be able to restrain myself. And also now, I mean, I dare not show my
face. Show your face. Yeah. Have you had any of them come and heckle you at talks or anything like that?
Interestingly, John and I are both ambassadors for the London Library. And it was at a London Library talk, and a Ripperologist stood up and told me that I was wrong, but that he hadn't actually read my book yet.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Like part of the course.
That's such a male thing. Sorry, John.
No, I know exactly what you mean.
Such a male thing to do. Go, you're wrong. I mean, I assume you're wrong. I haven't actually checked.
Yes.
But you're a woman, so you must have got it wrong.
Well, you must have got it wrong. You do realise they were prostitutes and there's lots of evidence. And I said, well... what evidence? And he said, well, what about when Polly Nichols left the lodging house? And she said, see what a jolly bonnet I'm wearing now. Well, see what a jolly bonnet I have now. And I said, how is that evidence that she was a prostitute?
It's what they want to believe. And I think that's what is at the heart of this, is the need to feel that these women were prostitutes, so that there is some sort of logic to it all, and there's some sort of meaning
also,
to their deaths.
You know. I mean, yes, I totally agree. But I also think, you know, you have to think that, you know, Ripperology is fraught with infighting. And the one thing that they can all agree on is that Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes. That is the one thing. It's like a cornerstone of Ripperology.
And you've taken that away.
And I pulled it out.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So my hope is that because of your book, this will gradually die away, this myth, and that we won't have... you know, video games of Jack the Ripper. We won't have graphic novels about Jack the Ripper and endless sort of jokey sort of Halloween characters.
Well, Halloween
Jack the
costumes
Ripper.
Of Jack the Ripper.
Well, I mean, there's a Canadian baseball team that was going to change their... There's a place in Ontario called London, so they were going to call themselves the London Rippers.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, that's terrible.
That's going to be their nickname. And it's like, And then the women's groups protested, and I think they stopped. Mm. But it's just like a joke. Being a
well, you know, you know about in the East End that there are businesses which use Jack the Ripper, where you allude to Jack the Ripper. So you have Jack the Clipper is a chain of barbershops. You have a Jack the Chipper, which is a chippy. And I hate to sound like a feminist killjoy, but actually, you know, that's kind of not funny.
No, I sort of agree with you, and I'm just slightly...
Well, you wouldn't have in Leeds, you wouldn't have the Yorkshire chipper.
No, you wouldn't.
That just wouldn't
no,
happen. You wouldn't. That's in people's living memory. Yes. You know, but it's still a serial killer that murdered women. Like.
Yeah, I always thought it was a slightly unfunny joke in... the sitcom where they've all got surnames of serial killers. Gavin and Stacey. They're all called the Sutcliffes and the Nielsens and the... And I always thought, really, guys, is that a funny joke? You know, it's sort of very sort of obliquely...
You know, I don't think I ever noticed that or knew that.
All their surnames are serial killers. They're Shipmans and the, you know... And it's like, it's not that funny, guys. People died.
Yeah.
But it's maybe a bit old square and boring, I think.
What I think is really interesting about your book as well, Hallie, is that... And we were talking about this a bit before you came in, is... The social history of it. A lot of what we're taught about the Victorians is very much about the middle and upper classes. We think of the Victorians as being, you know, those sort of terribly staid and oppressed people that were a bit kinky and interested in the macabre and all of that. But of course, that's very much the upper classes we're talking about there and their way. And actually, from your book, to get a real sense of my family are from the East End of London originally, or southeast of London, Deptford, Bermondsey, that sort of area. And to think of what their lives would have been like, you know, the reality of my family. We're not taught that.
No,
you know?
No,
so
exactly.
It's such a good overview of that, you know, the fear of the workhouse, the living hand to mouth, the casual work, all of that stuff. It's really fascinating. And that's the backdrop that's interesting, not this sort of saucy killer in the, you know,
in the fog.
Women in the fog with bar wenches and all that. Yeah. With sort of, it's just this horrific way that most of the country was living, most people...
Exactly, and it was most of the country as well.
Yes,
it was. Yeah. You know, if we, and again, you know, this is something that I say, it taps into something much bigger that's going on in history at the moment, which is telling these stories that have been cut out of the historical record and the way we talk about history. For example, if we look at the experiences of the working class, and if we look at the idea of what the Victorian world was like, was that everybody was very circumspect and very prudish. Well, if you look at the sexual practices of the working classes and the amount of people who had sex outside of marriage, and you realize that that was pretty normal, and you realize that the working classes were the majority of the population, then you can turn our understanding of Victorian sexual morals on its head. Because, you know, actually, most of the population probably was having sex before marriage.
Yes.
And was having children out of wedlock and was getting, you know, was shacking up with people who they weren't marrying. And the exception were the middle classes and the upper classes. And so actually that completely changes how we understand that period in history.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think also important point is that history is a constantly changing thing, and the history we all learnt at school isn't history. It's a version that was told from a certain perspective. And we have to sort of try and understand that that is going to evolve and change as we realize, you know,
and
it's not just about kings
that.
And queens.
People don't get that. And exactly, it's not just about kings and queens. And I think a lot of people don't understand that history is not fact, it's argument.
Yeah. And right, it's a discussion.
It's a discussion, and that discussion is always evolving and always changing. And perspectives are always shifting.
Thank you so much, Hallie, because the book was incredible. And I've said to John, it really hit home. And as I've just said then about the conditions, particularly for women. And the thing that really got me, I remember, and I've definitely cried, was, you know, when a woman wanted to leave her husband but just couldn't, you know, whether they were violent, whether they were... And just to be thankful... We've got a long way to go, hence we've still got a feminist agenda. But, you know, my God, have, you know, the fact that I've got autonomy and freedom and, you know, and that I physically can support myself financially, which was just an impossibility. So it's all very well making a moral judgment on women who were sex workers, but that could be the only way to feed you and your family. Literally the only way, you know, and you show me someone who wouldn't do whatever they had to do to feed their children.
But it's also, you know, again, what we considered sex work at the time, what it actually was, you know, I mean, even the police were talking about this. It was very, very difficult to distinguish working class practices around sexuality from actual sex work. Because if you're living at a time when any type of sex outside of marriage means the woman can be called a whore, and women were having sex outside of marriage because, you know, their partners left them, and women were financially dependent on men. Women could not earn a decent wage to keep themselves and their families without living with a man. And a lot of that happened outside of wedlock, and relationships were dissolved very quickly and then reformed with other people. And to the middle classes, this appeared like prostitution.
Yes, yes. And a modern perspective of prostitution is images of streetwalkers and rich men picking them up, much more mixed up.
Much more complex.
Yeah.
And actually that final chapter in your book really goes into that, doesn't it? And it's really, when you actually look at what the scope of so-called sex work prostitution is, that actually the fact they were labelled prostitutes doesn't mean they were prostitutes in the sense that we...
Understand it.
Exactly.
So if we take away anything from today, it's that you're all going to go on Wikipedia and other forums and challenge these things every time they see them. Too many men on Wikipedia, I would say. So women listeners, get on there and start sort of changing things. There's a reason.
We're too busy living in the real world, John.
I know, you're right. There's a reason that the Star Wars entry is longer than, you know, the Mary Shelley entry. Thank you, Hallie, for coming on We Are History and setting the record
straight
on Jack
Rabbit. Oh, absolute
congratulations
pleasure.
Again on your wonderful book and an achievement that few historians, I think, can claim to have really changed the narrative and made people look completely again at something that they thought they knew everything about. So thanks for coming on, and good luck with your next project. You're allowed
Thank
to share
you.
That with us?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm staying in true crime, and I am examining the murder of Belle Elmore by Dr. Crippen in 1910.
Oh, wow.
Very exciting.
Maybe another episode coming up.
Yes, we'll have to get you back when it's published. Thank you so much, Hallie.
Very welcome.
That's all from
Thank
We
you,
Are History.
Hallie. Don't forget to go onto Twitter at We Are History Pod. Let us know what you think. Give us any ideas for things you'd like us to cover. And go onto your Apple iTunes and give us a review. 5 stars, please, if you'd like, and write something nice, if you could. We've had one shitty review this week, so write loads of nice ones to
It was definitely a ripperologist.
We've only had one shitty review, though, John, so I'll take that. Do you know what I mean? I'll take that.
A 1 star. All right. That's all for this week. Catch you next time.
See you next time. Bye.